Welcome, folks, to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, bringing you continuing conversations about the cultures of consciousness. Haven't been on the air for a few weeks. PRN is in the midst of some technological transfer to a new studio system, and perhaps partly because Mercury retrograde is still in action, and partly because Verizon is an evil archon, the technological systems have not been completely dialed in. At the moment, we just have Skype, but a telephone will be returning. And apparently, they have new location as well. So I wish them the best, and I want to let everyone know that Mercury is going normal as of today, and it's been a tough one on me as well. So it's one bit of woo that I completely accept. Forgive me, oh skeptics listening. But I'm happy to be back to the show today. I've been working quite a lot on my writing process, my writing practice. I've been spending a lot of time diving into the deep weirdness of Philip K. Dick, writing about the exegesis, his crazy text that he produced following his remarkable mystical slash psychotic experiences of 1974. And one of the interesting things about Dick's experiences is that people often talk about the really crazy stuff that happened to him, the pink light and the beam of information and all these synchronicities and seeing this woman with a fish necklace that it, you know, turns into some mystic communication. But really the most consistent extraordinary experiences in his writings, in his private writings in the exegesis, are about dreams. And more than even about dreams, he includes a lot of dreams, and he usually interprets them as if they're sort of coded messages illuminating the great, you know, metaphysical, cosmological turbulence of reality. But most of the time, his dreams are actually not dreams proper, but hypnagogic experiences, experiences on the edge between dreaming and awakening, the kinds of things that happen as your brain goes to sleep or wakes up again from sleep into waking, although technically that's called hypnopompia, which Dick himself also knew. And Dick recognized that a lot of the experiences were occurring in hypnagogia. But it's a very strange state that there's very little writing about. Very few people talk about it as something separate from dream, or at least overlapping, a different modality of dream. But actually, a lot of the sort of messages and kind of mystical voices that Dick would hear in some of the images he would see, often of books or texts or faces, were appearing in this peculiar state of hypnagogia. And hypnagogia will be one of the things we're talking about today, in our podcast on liminal dreaming. Today I am pulling I can do it because I want to do it, a nepotism card, and having my wife on the show. But I'm doing that because she's been doing work on dreams and dreaming for many, many years in a variety of different modalities, and has this year really broken out in terms of doing a lot of workshops. She and I were both recently at Lightning in a Bottle, and I was very happy. I'm very happy to say that more people attended her talk than mine, and it went very well. Talking about liminal dreaming and techniques and thoughts about how we can approach the dream world, maybe in some different ways than people are used to thinking about. So I'm actually really happy to have her on the show and to sort of encourage her ideas and experiences to go out further into the realms. So with no further ado, let's bring Jennifer Dumpere onto the show.
Hello.
Hello, Jennifer Dumpere.
Hello, Eric Davis. How are you?
I can vaguely hear you speaking from the other room.
Yeah,
it's a little silly, but hey, we're going to do it. And you know, you're an authority now, so it's perfectly appropriate. And you came up with the tag liminal dreaming relatively recently to describe at least some of the work you've been doing with dreams. And I just wanted to start out just asking you to explain liminal dreaming.
Okay. So liminal dreaming is about, as you were saying, hypnagogia and hypnopompia, which are the states of moving into sleep or moving out of sleep. And I can describe that in terms of brainwaves, something a little bit more. But these states of mind, which together are called hypnoidal dream states, it's really about that surfing the edge of conscious and unconscious, between awake and not awake. And everybody is familiar with this. When you're falling asleep and your body jerks, or you have that feeling of falling, or when you're waking up and slowly and moving back and forth between thought and dream, and also when you're really sleepy, when you nap, when you are trying to stay awake and you go into those little bit of dream state, those are all hypnoidal dreams. And it's a very weird, wonderful, wild state of mind that with some practice you can open up and spend a bunch of time there. And it's both great to mine for creativity and ideas. It's also just wonderful to have as the experience and in the way, you know, I mean, my underlying premise of all the dream work I do is that humans are inherently motivated to experiment with consciousness. Little kids roll down hills and spin in circles. And as adults, we do all sorts of things, sex and drugs and all night trance and dance and sweat lodges. There's all sorts of things that we do as a way of experimenting with consciousness. So the idea behind liminal dreaming is really about opening up that space, like surfing the very, very edge of consciousness in order to have these incredible experiences and maybe to do things with them.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's interesting, and I know this has been your experience because I've seen you have conversations with people about dreams so often, is that it's just amazing how much of the time you start talking about dreaming and you start talking about it in terms of practices rather than interpretations. You know, what do you do? And everybody immediately just goes to lucid dreaming. It's always about lucid dreaming. People want a lucid dream. They're fascinated with it. They love it. If they've had the experiences, sometimes they get incredibly obsessed with it. And, you know, as someone who's had many lucid dreams, they're super nifty. But you're talking about something different. And in a way, I think it's kind of interesting to, like, well, you know, compare them and maybe reflect a little bit on maybe why people are so obsessed with lucid dreams or how that obsession has kind of hidden some other possibilities in the dreaming realm that are equally rich and exciting.
Sure. So liminal dreaming I do get this question a lot. It's not the same thing as lucid dreaming, although it's kind of on the path toward lucid dreaming. The traditional lucid dreamers are the Tibetan Buddhists, and the Tibetan Buddhists do something called dream yoga, which is a lucid dreaming practice. The idea is really learning to be conscious in the lucid dream. For anybody who doesn't know what a lucid dream is, in case you've been living on Mars, lucid dreaming is that state where your waking consciousness comes through in the dream. And you can control the dream, and you can fly and pass through walls and all that kind of thing. And so in the West, people have known about lucid dreaming forever, although it came to greater attention when Stephen LeBarge did some marvelous studies in the 80s at the Stanford Sleep Lab, hooking people up during lucid dreams and having them signal by moving their eyes left, right, that they were in a lucid dream, and then practicing some singing opera or doing math problems or cartwheeling, things that they could also hook them up to do when waking so that they could compare what happens in a dream when people do these things and what happens when they're doing it awake. And through these studies, you're sort of able to prove that lucid dreaming does exist, which was, of course, a thing doubted in modern science. But Tibetan Buddhists have been doing this practice for a long time. And the idea with the Tibetan Buddhists was that you want to remain conscious in a dream as a way of teaching yourself that all life is a dream and that you're dealing with all life as if it's a dream. Also so that you can keep your wits about you in the bardo, which is basically like a really bad dream. But the Tibetan Buddhists also practiced liminal dreaming, and that's what a lot of people call lucid dreaming. If you read the classic book on the Tibetan Buddhist dream practices by Namgka Norbu called Dream Yoga and the Practice of Natural Light, which is a great book. Just look for Dream Yoga. He talks about how to begin practice lucid dreaming by imagining this glowing red om on your heart. And it's really a lot of it's really a practice of liminal dreaming. It's really a practice of keeping your mind about you as you fall asleep. I think people are really into lucid dreaming for a few reasons. One, because you always have control of your surroundings, and I think people are kind of driven to always have control of their surroundings, which I don't actually think is necessarily the best urge. People also just like the amazing experience of having a kind of a consciousness in dream state. Again, I go back to people love to play with their minds. They love to play with consciousness. And so lucid dreaming is a great way to do that. But liminal dreaming is also a great way to do that. It is free of a lot of the ego constraints because it is a little bit less of a subject-object relationship. You don't have as much of a reactive environment. You also don't.
Well, I mean, isn't it that partly that, like, I mean, my experience, because I've met a lot of people really into lucid dreaming, you know, people who are doing a lot of consciousness exploration, or they're doing occultism, or they're doing Tibetan Buddhism, or whatever. And one thing that I found that I always sort of noticed is that when people would talk about their experiences and they'd start to tell you about them, that there was, as you said, there was often a lot of ego in it, which is fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if I'm, you know, whatever, I'm at Lightning in a Bottle, and like there's some cool place to go and someone did some great thing and they're talking to me and I'm like, yeah, let's go, let's jump over there, let's do that. You know, I mean, that's me making decisions about what to do based on what I want, which is, again, totally fine. But I've noticed that sometimes people talk about lucid dreaming, they seem to be kind of, there's a potential to get obsessed with the kind of control of it, like, I can now control my world. I can do what I want. I can make love with that person. I can, you know, become a monster. I can, you know, fly to the farthest heavens. And there's something exciting and kind of science fictional about it. But in a way, it's also very different, at least in my experience, than the kinds of things that happen in these states of liminal dreaming, which often require much more of a sort of I don't even know how to say it exactly, but you're kind of just witnessing or allowing something to come to be, to reveal itself. There's more of a sort of a kind of meditative mind, if you will, going into it, rather than the kind of desire to break through and be able to sort of have your own virtual reality and do whatever you want to do in it.
Yeah, it's definitely much less ego-based. Hypnagogia and hypnopompia, hypnoidal dream states, are super slippery. It's very hard to pin it down. And in that way is, in my experience, often a weirder environment than the lucid dream. I mean, lucid dreams are weird, don't get me wrong. But liminal dreaming is also a super strange, very different kind of experience for most of what our consciousness does. And with lucid dreaming, by the way, is difficult to do. So some people are natural lucid dreamers, people like Stephen LeBerge, or often people who remember their dreams, like me, pretty regularly, go through a phase of natural lucid dreaming, often in their teens, late adolescence, or in your teens. My first one was really in my teens. But But everybody is a natural liminal dreamer. Everybody goes through hypnagogia and hypnopompia. It's super, super easy to open up the space. So it's both, in terms of a comparison to lucid dreaming, it's both just as weird and interesting, and in my mind, in some ways, a lot weirder and more interesting. It's a lot easier. And for people who are actually still interested in lucid dreaming, it's traditionally what you learn first. You pass through this some kinds of the practices that I've kind of shifted around and changed from what the Tibetan Buddhists do into this liminal dreaming as its own end. But traditionally, it's also what you would pass through as you were trying to learn lucid dreaming.
Well, one of the things also about liminal dreaming is that there's much less of a sort of discourse around it in our culture, even among people who are pursuing altered states, who are interested in the multiplicity of consciousness, or who are interested in the encountering the unconscious or entering into visionary states. There's again a lot of language around dreams, how to interpret dreams, maybe how to achieve lucidity in dreams, but much, much less about how to surface, in your terms, these sort of different kinds of these hypnoidal states. But personally, as you know, I have gotten a lot of my most exciting and interesting and insightful and bizarre dream experiences precisely in these hypnoidal states, usually going to sleep, where I discover to my amazement that I am still awake and present as I enter into the dream state. And I've been able to witness and subsequently experience a really very different kind of experiential states than deep dreaming. I mean, I've had the experience of witnessing the sort of it's almost as if I'm looking at a screen, like a film screen, like I'm just sitting in the audience and I'm like, oh, look, I'm looking at a film screen. It's just some abstract, vaguely black wall of my inner eyelids, nothing going on. And then I'll notice like a few little blips and blops of abstract flashes of light, you know, phosphenes is how you'd identify it technically. And then I'm watching those and, oh, they're kind of pretty. And then they get more evolved and they're like, there become patterns, and then those patterns, and I remember very distinctly watching a few abstract images pop into a triangle, and then the triangle popped into a pyramid, and then the pyramid was located in a whole fantastic landscape, and I just saw the landscape emerge, and it was like I was watching my own mind begin to weave deeper states of dreaming, the visionary three-dimensional narrative worlds. It was beginning to weave that out of these kind of little bits and flashes of abstract neural circuitry. And I was witnessing the whole thing going, wow, this is totally incredible. And I've had tons of experiences like that, but people don't talk about them as much, or even though as you've discovered, they play a really important role in history too. I mean, like a lot of scientists have explored this state, and writers and painters and surrealists have gone into this state. But for some reason, like I wasn't really ready for it in a way. I had to kind of discover it on my own.
Well, I think a lot of what's going on is that people don't really know about these dream states. When I give these lectures and workshops, people often say, oh gosh, that has a name. That's a thing. And so again, with lucid dreaming, some people were natural lucid dreamers, but it didn't hit the common cultural consciousness until the last couple decades. And so certainly you didn't have people lucid dreaming as much as they do now. And again, partly because people didn't know about it. I mean, something that's information often opens up the space of possibilities. Someone's like, oh, okay, well, now that I know that those weird states that I go to as I'm drifting off to sleep or as I'm waking up or as I'm napping, now that I know that those actually have a name and that there's something that I can channel and do something with, then the possibility really, really begins to exist that it's something that you can play with. You mentioned the artists and scientists and what have you. And there's a really great tradition of working with hypnoidal dream states. So I was talking earlier about this is a tool learning liminal dreaming as a tool for either just playing and experimenting with, but it's also, with mind, it's also something that you can harness. So a lot of discoveries and inspiration have come in the past through hypnoidal dream states. For example, you know, I can never say that, I don't know how to say the name, Kekule, I think, who conceived, discovered isn't quite the right word, but understood the benzene ring in a hypnagogic dream state. It's a problem that he had been working on for a really long time, and then he started to drift off, entered a hypnagogic dream state, had a vision of the Ouroboros, the snake eating its tail, and aha, came to him, the benzene ring. Both Salvador Dali and Thomas Edison, independently of each other, came up with basically the same practice. Edison as a way of generating ideas. And of course, you know, Edison invented everything. Dali as a way of coming up with ideas for art. And what they would do is both men took metal plates. So Edison had two on the sides of his comfy chair and Dali had one on the ground. And then Edison would hold two balls in his hand. Dali would hold, he's very specific, a big brass Spanish key in his hand. And when they were tired during the day and feeling kind of nappy, they would each man would sit in the chair and go through hypnagogia, holding the key in the hand or the balls in hands. And then, of course, once hypnagogia turned into sleep, they would drop either the balls or the key. And Dali kept a sketch pad next to him, and Edison kept a notepad next to him. And as soon as they woke up, immediately Dali would start sketching, or Edison would start writing out whatever ideas he had come up with. And there's a very, very, very rich tradition. There's a book called The Committee of Sleep by Deirdre Barrett, where you can read a lot about the ways that artists and thinkers have used dreams to solve problems and to plumb for creativity. And working with hypnagogia is really one of the primary ways.
I'd love to talk a little bit more about what kind of phenomena are associated with the liminal dreaming state. You know, again, I think one thing that people often see are sort of faces, as if you're sort of looking at a kind of translucent black screen out of which these kind of sometimes ominous faces, but they're sort of sketched out. That often seems to be an element that a lot of people talk about, or, you know, very, very visually abstract images, but things that look a little different than the kind of images we see in dreams later on in the night. What are some of the other kinds of experiences or sensations that are associated particularly with these hypnoidal states as opposed to REM dreams?
So there, like you said earlier, there has not been a lot of work done on hypnagogia, hypnopompia, more on hypnagogia than on hypnopompia. And they're very similar but different states. And I can talk to you about the brain waves, which is a little interesting. But first, let me answer your question. So there's this guy named Mavromatis. I don't know how to say it. And he did a bunch of work on hypnagogia. And he came up with what he considered to be like the four stages of hypnagogia. And as you're drifting off to sleep, you'll often recognize these yourself. And they start with just kind of light and color, maybe points of light, flashes, that kind of thing. And then move into the floating and drifting scenes. And that's when there are a lot of faces. This is a very common phenomenon when I talk to people. As they're drifting off, you see a face turning toward you, or faces, or maybe a crowd of faces. And then that moves into sort of symbolic, he calls it symbolic phenomenon, but really basically it's images. It moves into sort of particular images, and then from there moves into more narrative dream. But hypnagogic dream is a little bit more fast changing than often the narrative of a dream. But the final stage of a kind of hypnagogic dream is this more narrative dream state.
So you were talking about the brainwaves, and you know, I mean, you know, one can get really technical with all this, but what are you can really see the difference between these states in even just the basic brainwaves that we've been familiar with since the 60s, at least.
Right. So the hypnagogic. So when you're awake, right, your mind is either in like relaxed awake, and that's alpha wave, so that's like 8 to 13 hertz per second, you know, like a sound wave, right? So it cycles 8 to 13 times per second, or else you're in beta, which is cycling even higher, then you're more like, you know, 10 to 15 hertz per second. During the course of, and I won't get too technical with this, but just to give you a sense, during the course of the night, a stage of sleep is measured by every 1.5 hours. More or less, you wake up every hour and a half. And the first thing that happens when you're falling asleep is that your brain waves go from this either alpha or beta. So like, let's say from alpha, 8 to 13 hertz per second. And you go down into stage 2 sleep, which is theta waves. And that's 4 to 7, right? So much slower, 8 to 13 and alpha, sort of relaxed attention, and 4 to 7 in stage 2 sleep. And most of the night, you're in stage 2 sleep. But while you're falling asleep, while you're going through hypnagogia, your brain waves are jumping all over the place, right? So they're as they settle in. So it's a super chaotic state, right? Which is part of. I mean, I don't think that you can totally reduce mind to what's happening in brain, but if you superimpose what we know is happening in brain with what you see is happening in your mind, often you find some clarity there. So the hypnagogia, you're going from awake to stage 2, and so it's this weird kind of chaos. And hypnopompia, on the other end of the spectrum, when you're waking up, is usually coming out of REM, right? So REM is when you're lucid dreaming or when you're just having regular narrative dreams. That's more often in REM than in any other of the sleep states. One of the things that's really interesting about REM is that as a brainwave state, it actually looks a lot in awake state, either an alpha state or even a beta state, even like the more, you know, where you're really paying close attention to something, awake state. So a sleeping person's brainwaves, and if they're in REM, are, you know, sort of rapid voltage EEG. Hypnopompia is moving from REM into an awake state. So your brainwaves are much more similar, right? So hypnagogia often has the character of it's very weird and it's fast changing and there's these kicks and these jerks and you have a lot of auditory phenomenon. And then hypnopompia often has the characteristic of a very, very, you're drifting very much back and forth between thought and dream. And those of us who wake up slowly, people with long circadian rhythms generally, those of us who wake up slowly are really familiar with the phenomenon of you're starting to think about something and then thought turns into a dream and then it might be a full dream and then you realize that actually it's a thought and you're kind of awake again. It's very much a drift. If you think about like water and land, right? Where the ocean meets the land is where it throws up all of those waves. It throws up all of that kind of chaos. And of course, that's what you can surf, right? You can surf the waves at the edge because that's what's being produced. So hypnagogia and hypnopompia are kind of like the same. Think about it as like the ocean is the unconscious and the land is the consciousness and the hypnoidal states on the right on the edges is where all these waves are being thrown up, and that's what you can surf.
I love that analogy. It's so good because you're talking about surfing these states, but it also explains kind of why would you do this? And it's just like surfing's fun, you know. Even before you get into it's meaningful, or I'm going to get an idea to help my science, or inspire my poem, or understand the nature of my unconscious, or all those sort of reasons that people have about dreaming, and you know, when they start taking dreaming seriously, because usually people they ignore it, or they kind of think like that the dream is about getting a mess, garbage. You know, it's like you got to interpret it. You got to use it somehow. But in a way, there's something in between, which is just the kind of joy of experiencing these flows as they encounter and as they mix up. But we got to take a break right now, so we'll talk more about this stuff after our break. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network, and talking with Jennifer Dumpere, and we'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Expand Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. Eric Davis here, speaking with Jennifer Dumpere about liminal dreaming. Obviously, people aren't going to get super into dreaming unless they're already really into dreaming, and you're kind of a remarkable dreamer. So I'd just love to hear a little bit about how your own kind of practice with dreams and your own experience of dreams has evolved, over the years, because you've come up with a lot of interesting ways of playing with the dream states and bringing them back into our normal reality. What were some of the most significant, without getting into the whole like telling a dream story, some of the more significant things you started to discover about your deep dream life that led you to practice more seriously and really start to study on the history and science of dreams?
I've always been very steeped in my dreams. A lot of my earliest childhood memories are dreams. I had a recurrent nightmare as a child of being chased through a haunted house. Scooby-Doo and I were being chased through a haunted house by a framed painting and a Sherlock Holmes hat. But there really actually was a watershed moment. I was living in Paris in the late 80s, and in a dream, I looked around and I realized that I knew where I was, that it was a different version of Buffalo, New York, where I grew up. And in the dream, I remembered other dreams that I had had in this same setting, and realized that I kind of had a map, that I went back to the same place, that it was a dream location, my own version, and that it had constancy. And when I woke up, I realized that sometimes you have memories in dreams and they're false memories. But when I woke up, I actually remembered those other dreams that in the dream I had remembered. I remembered actually having them. So in the actual dream state, when I became aware of a constancy of the objective world, I started to realize that there was also a constancy of the dream subject, of the self that I am when I'm dreaming. And over the years after that, I really started to open that up and explore that. And I began to cultivate and understand that the me that I am when I am dreaming is a slightly different me from the me that I am here when I am awake and talking. And that me that I am in the dreams has different habits, has different memories, very, very similar to me. It's almost like a moiré pattern overlay, just shifts a little bit. And from that realization that the external world had constancy of places that I could go back to, and my internal self was a self that I could go back to, was really when I started doing a lot of experimentation. And by the way, I once had the experience, it was so extremely weird, but so lucid dreaming, when this consciousness, when the awake consciousness steps to the fore in the dream, I once had happen in reverse, where the dreaming self that I am came to the fore when I was awake. And it was just as weird as a lucid dream, but of course, in the reverse. So that was in the late 80s, and that was what really started my serious dream work.
And when you, one of the kind of issues, I guess, is to figure out, like, well, what do you do with this stuff? How do you move things back and forth? I mean, in a way, if the action in dreaming in general, but certainly in liminal dreaming, it occurs at this, the beach, the coastline between the unconscious of the ocean and the waking solid land of everyday awareness. That also implies that one of the ways to play with dreaming in a creative and possibly, you know, psycho-spiritual way is to sort of move things back and forth in a way across that. And I know that some of your personal dream practices have come up with ways of indeed kind of bringing things from the dreaming and unfolding them into your everyday life, and particularly the practice you call the urban dreamscape. So, tell us about the urban dreamscape.
Sure. The urban dreamscape was a way that I developed a very long time ago, I don't know, over 20 years ago, living in New York City, of bringing the dream world into this world. So how do, if you're not interested in interpretation, and I'm not, that's not what I'm on about, how do you work with dreams? And one of the way that I first developed was basically using active imagination and visualization techniques to superimpose the dream onto the neighborhood, basically to use the neighborhood as a dream journal. And I started doing this when I was living in New York, and then in San Francisco, in my current neighborhood, I do the same thing. And the way that it works is I take a dream in the morning, and I put it into imagination-sized pieces, like bite-sized pieces, a particular image, a particular feeling, what have you, in kind of a narrative order. And then I superimpose each element onto the architecture in the neighborhood so that the scan of the eye reproduces the dream. So, for example, there's a local sushi restaurant that's next to a brick building that has a nice stone scrollwork. And I had a dream about these whales. And the first part of the dream, I'm in the water waiting for the whales. That's one part. Another part of the dream, the next part of the dream, there's people in a zodiac looking at the whales. The third part of the dream is the whales are spinning around in the water, etc. And so if you look at the restaurant, the first part of the dream where I'm waiting for the whales is superimposed onto these, like, these flying rafters that are underneath the roof. And then the next part of the dream, the people in the zodiac, is where the eye next goes, which is along the edge of the brick building, and the whale spinning around is at the stone scrollwork. And so what happens is, as I'm going along the street, I'll suddenly catch a glimpse of a dream, some written onto the architecture, and then I'll remember it. So the city becomes a dream journal. And to do that, I used, I don't want to go too far into these, but for people who know what they are, I used both art of memory, you know, the ancient way of that orators used to memorize things, and also Australian Aboriginal song lines, where the original time is the dream of the creator, and people actually, when doing walkabout, are existing both in this shared consensus reality world and also in the time of the original dream. And so for me, it's the same thing. I'm walking down the street, and then suddenly I am both in my city, and then I'm also in the middle of the dream I had through recalling it in the architecture.
Practice to the practice of dream walking when you are in an unfamiliar part of a city or a landscape, and instead of just sort of wandering around aimlessly as you normally would, you wander around aimlessly as you would a dream, letting yourself be attracted to those most peculiar elements of the landscape, odd images, strange street names, anything that seems kind of synchronistic or magical. And it often takes very little time before you're suddenly wandering through a dream realm. And then again, it's that same balance of bringing dream into the real world.
Right. So the situationist had what they call the devise, which is sort of walking without purpose. And one, I have a lot of practices of what Dale Pendle and I call the interdimensional smuggling. And a lot of the ways that I work with dreams are through taking images or feelings back and forth between dream world and waking world. So I have a dream walk that I like to do. So if in the dream I have a dream about maybe a guy in a red hat, then all day long I'm looking for guys in red hats who maybe I'll even, in a foreign city, I might even follow as a way of working with the dream. Or when I give workshops, I have a lot of dreams about being inappropriately barefoot. Sometimes I'm inappropriately barefoot because the terrain is, you know, rocky and rough and there are biting insects. And sometimes I am inappropriately barefoot because of social mores. I went to a black tie formal event at the Icelandic consulate and I was barefoot. So one of the ways that I work with these dreams is when I give lectures and workshops on dreaming, I do it barefoot, which is often a little awkward and slightly embarrassing. And that's a way of working with the awkward, embarrassing thing that happens in the dream. So interdimensional smuggling, and you can go the other way. You can try to bring things from awake into the dream, which I've managed to do, but that's definitely interdimensional smuggling, you know, advanced practice. It's a lot harder to do, but it's a lot like the liminal dreaming, right? Breaking down sort of the border space between dream and awake, which I think is one of the most interesting ways of working with dreams.
One of the things you do in the workshops that you give and some of the materials you produced is give people more specific practices and also different herbs or narogens, as you call them, that sort of encourage or support these kinds of states. And it turns out that there's a lot of things that really work. You know, it's kind of funny. You know, you hear like, oh, this is going to help you do this. And this is going to, you know, there's a lot of scents and mixtures and herbs and things that people make claims for. But, you know, in my experience, a lot of the things you've talked about really have remarkable effects. So in terms of things that people can do to encourage or support liminal dreaming, what are some of the things that seem the most effective?
Well, both. So for liminal dreaming, so an onergen is anything that promotes really vivid dreaming. And there's a lot of onergens that are scents and sounds, because when you're sleeping, your sense of smell doesn't change and your sense of hearing doesn't change. There are a lot of onergens that are herbs, things like, galantamine, which is red spider lily, or mugwort, both of which are really effective onergens for having any kind of, REM dreams and liminal dreams. And then there are a lot of practices, things that you can do. So for Tibetan dream yoga. So for practices that are really specifically focused on liminal dreaming, my favorite one is one that I call the feedback loop. And the way that works, and really most of these are about, again, opening up the space of the hypnoidal dream, spending more time there with a little bit of practice. You can really learn to linger there and surf that state. It's also about keeping brainwaves kind of closer to earlier I was about different brainwaves. And basically when you're sleeping, the closer your brainwaves are to awake, the better the dreams are. So the first one, the feedback loop, is partly about staying conscious of the moment that you fall asleep, which is a different exercise. But one of the ways that I got involved in this whole liminal dreaming was I started in my 20s having the experience of having my body fall asleep while my mind was still awake. And now I've gotten to the point where most of the time I can kind of catch the moment when I really fall asleep, and my body will fall asleep, but my mind is still a little bit awake, and that's when you really start to have these amazing liminal dreams. So this practice, feedback loop. And this one, what you do is when you're lying in bed, you concentrate, you let arise probably whatever visual naturally arises. Some people are auditory, and especially in dreams. And if you're somebody who's more aural, which is such an annoying word, if you're somebody who's more sound-based, you can do this with a sound that arises, but most of us are visual. So when you lie down and relax and close your eyes, usually you'll have some sort of visual phenomenon on it, even if it's just points of light or something moving. Or it might be a thought. If you don't really have any visual, you can start it with a light thought. And what you do is you breathe into whatever that image is. So maybe you've got some points of light. You breathe into it. And as you breathe, you use the exhale to really relax your body and use the out-breath to breathe energy into this image, whatever it is that you're seeing. And as you're relaxing your body, you'll start to get sleepier. And as you're breathing energy into this image, the image will sort of start to take on its own moving, changing shape. And then you'll see that, right? And then that sort of the feedback loop is between you and the image. So then the image is shifting and changing. And then again, you exhale, breathe energy into the shifting, changing image while relaxing your body. And through this feedback loop, what the image is starts to turn into a liminal dream. You start to go through those hypnagogic dream states. So that's a really good one for hypnagogia. And really, a lot of what you need to do is you need to stay aware enough so that you don't fall all the way asleep, but you need to relax enough so that your mind doesn't take over. Because again, you're trying to find the space between attention and awake and unconscious and asleep. So that's a really good
one. Yeah, for me, one of the ones that I've used in that's a different way of saying the same kind of thing, is to really just look at the gaze out of my closed eyelids, so to speak, as if I'm looking at a screen, and I get into the film goer state of mind. Because when you go into a film, the movie starts, you kind of settle in to this state that at once is very relaxed. You're not identifying with your body, you're not talking, you're not interacting with the world, and on the other hand, you're very alert and ready for an event to occur that you're going to be involved with, but you're not actually controlling. So it's, for me, not that dissimilar from a lot of hypnagogia. And so I'll literally just like stare at this blank screen, almost as if I'm waiting for the movie to start. And by keeping that mind and keep returning to that mind as if I'm, you know, at a theater, maybe I'm getting a little sleepy and I want to wake up so I can see the movie. That's often been a way to get to that sweet spot, just by, you know, gazing out of my eyes, even though my eyes are closed.
Yep. Another good one for the other end of the spectrum for hypnopompia is that most of us have the regular body positions in which you sleep and dream, right? I mean, I sleep on my left side with my fist on my forehead, or my right side with my fist on my forehead, or on my back with my arms over my head. And when I am just slowly waking up, so if you want to work with hypnopompia, try to wake up as slowly as possible, and then try to find the body position in which you know you sleep. So because body has memory. Anybody who plays an instrument or does any kind of sports or gymnastics or yoga or whatever knows that body has its own memory. And so when you're drifting away, and this is one that you have to have if you're not waking up to an alarm clock, you have to be able to wake up very, very slowly. Try to find the position in which you know you sleep, and then again, really relax into it and let your mind drift. And often your body will bring back the memory of the dreams you've been having, because keep in mind, you're usually coming out of REM. And then you'll be able to really surf between awake and what that dream state was. And if you can't find anything there, shift over and get into a different position, one of the other positions in which you sleep. And if you don't know them, just pay attention over the next couple of weeks and you'll start to see the positions where you sleep. And that's a great way of working with hypnopompia and really going back and forth across those edges. And then I'll give you one more. An onerogen that is something that you take that's particularly good for actual sleep paralysis. So sleep paralysis is a phenomenon of hypnoidal dream state. And what's happening in sleep paralysis, there's what's happening subjectively and whatever. Like I said, I don't like to reduce these things just to brain. I think there's a lot more to it than that. But what's happening in your brain and in the chemicals in your body during sleep paralysis is that all the chemicals that basically paralyze your body so that you don't act out your dreams, so that you don't get up and walk around or talk or whatever, which often involves acetylcholine, you're waking up, so your mind is not quite awake. You're probably going from REM into hypnopompia. you might be going to, from hypnagogia, but you're probably going from random to hypnopompia, and your body is still flooded, so you're paralyzed, and you kind of think you're waking up, but you're still in the dream, and there's the phenomenon of you think you're awake, you're paralyzed, and then often there's an entity involved. There's some creature, there's some figure. A lot of people find this to be a fairly terrifying experience, and some people are really prone to it. But one of the things that you can do is you can actually really learn to work with that state of mind. You can kind of invite it in, and often the way that you deal with things that are supposed to be by inviting them in. So my friend Ryan Hurd, who has dreamstudies.org and is a great dream worker, wrote a book called Sleep Paralysis, and he gave me the tip of low doses of melatonin will bring are really good for bringing on sleep paralysis. Like a 3 milligram dose of melatonin, and take that before you go to sleep, and then be prepared for the potentiality of sleep paralysis, but go to sleep with the intention of maybe getting to know this entity or trying to take charge of the state, or at least make yourself comfortable within the state.
Yeah, it seems like one of the things I'm getting, is, as well as these sort of herbs and compounds that can support things, it's also a lot about your own attitude. You know, the more attention you bring and the more willingness you bring, it kind of feeds back again. You talked about the feedback loop earlier. It seems really like dealing with these other states is really a lot about refining that feedback mechanism and bringing yourself to the conversation. The more you bring yourself to the conversation, the more it talks back in a way. And so it's like we have that, we can begin to guide our own experience of it through the decisions we make and the attention and the creativity we bring to the encounter. And if you don't do that, maybe, you know, not much that happens sometimes. You know, it's really partly in our own hands.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you said earlier about lucid dreaming, and I was saying, well, people didn't really know lucid dreaming existed. And now once people know about it and they really put their attention into it, there's a lot more people having lucid dreams. Well, liminal dreaming is actually a super easy space to access as long as you know that it's there. You can go to my little bit of a plug, but you can go to liminaldreaming.com. And there are a whole bunch of exercises there for playing with it. And one of the things that I have found is people who are coming to my workshops or my lectures are starting to play around with this. And it's actually with a very, very little bit of attention and effort and intention, it's super easy to open up these spaces.
Well, that's great. What else are you working on with the site or other things you're doing with Dreamy? I know you're giving a lot of talks and things.
I'm giving a lot of talks. The liminaldreaming.com website is a pretty new one. There's urbandreamscape.com talks both about that urban dreamscape practice and also about the Oneronauticum, which is the international dream group that I've had going since 2008. But currently a lot of members in South America and Central America and Mexico, in addition to the States. I'm in the process of writing a book about all of these different dream practices and forms of dream work. I'll be doing an Oneronauticum and giving a workshop at the Women's Visionary Congress on June 21st. That's the next thing I have coming up.
Well, that sounds great. well, wife of mine, Ms. Jennifer Dumpere, you've already pointed people to your website, and so thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks for having me.
All right, kids out there, from me here, Eric Davis, to all you out there, keep your minds open.